pastoral care for the chronically discouraged and depressed. And I intend for this not to be discouraging and depressing as a session, all right? I hope that it will be an encouragement to you. I also am aware that all of you know something about this topic, not only because of contacts you have in caring for God's people, you know, those chronically discouraged and depressed people, but I'm confident you know something about this because we are all people with emotion as well, aren't we? And sometimes we, maybe hopefully not chronically, but sometimes we are discouraged and depressed. We run out of gas. We meet with one too many people. We see one too many hard-hearted individuals we talk to who won't change. And as people who care for others, we can get discouraged and depressed too. So I would want you to interact with what we're going to think about today, not only on a professional level of how you can help others with this, but on a very personal level about how you interact with these topics, okay? There are two parts that I want to do, okay? One is a case study, and you'll see why. And then I want to talk about four elements that I think are helpful to the discussion about how we care for chronically discouraged and depressed people. I want to just mention my wife this year. Kathy is with me. She was not here last year, but she's here this year. She was here with me back in 2018 as well, but she's along, and I'm grateful. She is my partner in crime and in many, many cases, sitting in on meetings with people. I am always intrigued by the questions that Jesus asked people. And one of these was mentioned, I think it was last night, in the plenary session. I went, huh, I had this written ahead of time. I'm just telling you now. But there are two times, at least, that Jesus asked interesting questions of people. I preached a sermon series on this once called Questions Jesus Asked. And I just pulled from the gospel those intriguing questions that Jesus asked that were intended to surface something deeper. So I'm giving you two here, and I just want you to think with me. These are interesting introductions. So Matthew chapter 20, in verse 32, this is the one you heard mentioned last night. The Bible says this, as I start reading at verse 29, as they went out of Jericho, a great crowd followed him, and behold, there were two blind men sitting by the roadside. And when they heard that Jesus was passing by, they cried out, Lord, have mercy on us, son of David. It's a very messianic identification, son of David. The crowd rebuked them, telling them to be silent. They cried out all the more, Lord, have mercy on us, son of David. And stopping, Jesus called them and said, what do you want me to do for you? Now, what kind of a weird question is that to say to a person who can't see? What would you like? You heard said last night, the language of the currency, let's see, how did they put, was it Heather who did this? I think it was. Yes, the currency of the kingdom is to ask. That was wonderful. That was so good. To ask, what would you like me to do for you? And to give that person the opportunity to say, well, I want to see. Now, Jesus does it again in John 5, 6 in a very similar setting. This is the pool of Bethesda. This is the man who's been an invalid for 38 years. Can you imagine? Your job is begging. You cannot imagine anything else. There is zero hope, zero, of being healed. This cannot happen in this day. The rest of your life, you will lie there on the side of this pool hoping somehow for a miracle that probably will not come. 38 years bound by this. And here comes Jesus, looks at the man in his situation and says in verse 6, do you want to be healed? Do you want to be healed? Now, we could exegete this at some length. I have asked this of people that I have counseled. I've asked them, do you want to get through this? Or is it really, I'm asking them to think about this. Or is it really, is this identity of a sufferer, one that you're so used to, that you feel like you wouldn't know what to do if you weren't depressed anymore, it'd be kind of scary. You'd have to get up and go do something and enter life. And do you want to get through this? Do you want to come out the other side? I've asked this question to people. Do you want to be well? Really, I'm asking. Do you want to be made well? And once you hear, well, you know, I think so, maybe, you can begin a process. But I've returned to this many times. Now, that question is an introduction to this. I'd like to do a case study with you. Okay, you're familiar with case studies. This is going to take a few minutes. I'm going to say the first half of our session. Okay? I want to introduce you to a man by the name of William Cooper. That's the old spelling of Cooper. Some people have said Cowper, but it isn't. William Cooper, I want to tell you his story. And I want you to be listening for these things as I tell his story. Think about these things as it relates to his story. Interaction with faith. Okay? So how many of you know the story of William Cooper? Somewhat, a little bit? Tiny, good. A couple of you have at least heard the name, good. Maybe you know more than that. So join me in the story of a chronically depressed person who came to faith and was still chronically depressed and discouraged. William Cooper was born in 1731, died in 1800. He struggled with mental health issues, we would say, his entire life. A short snapshot of the big picture of the mental health issues. He had major depressive episodes approximately every 10 years, routinely. He struggled with suicidal thoughts, ideation, and habits. He attempted suicide numerous times. So that's the big picture. When he died in despair, really. He died at a very dark time. And someone who saw him after he died said of his facial expression in death, there was a look of surprise on his face. I suspect because at that moment, he saw the presence of Christ and was fully healed in a moment. And part of what he struggled with was doubting that he could truly be saved because he was such a mess. So I go to the end before we go to the beginning, okay? As with many families of that time, William Cooper was born into a family that struggled with loss, sickness, loss, and death. Before he was born, three other siblings had been born and died. Then along came William. There were a couple others after him who also died. Another brother came along, John. His mom died in childbirth. And so at the age of six, William Cooper found himself an only child. His dad was some kind of a rector, a pastor of his day, probably not converted. I know, it happened then, it happens now. So a dad who has lost a handful of kids, has one surviving, and now has lost his wife. There were a couple of household servants that assisted with the care of children, didn't know what to do about this kid, William, and manipulated him horribly by telling him, no, really, he remembered this years later, that if he behaved well, his mother would come back. Tell this to a six-year-old to try to get them to behave. Finally, when he was a little bit older, not much, like I think 10, his dad, not knowing what else to do, sent him away to a boarding school. That's what you do to your bruised and lonely child. Send them away. What a brilliant idea. Off he goes to boarding school where he is bullied. He is not the athletic type. He is an artistic personality. Do you know what I mean by this? He is tender. He's not the big brawny ball player. He isn't. He's got a tender personality that comes from birth, by his personality, God-given personality, as well as the growing up in a home full of loss and sadness. So his teenage years, filled with studies, he was actually pretty good at Greek and Latin and those things. Throughout the rest of his life, he knew those other languages and could translate other, like Homer and some of these things, even 50 years after studying them in his younger years. He was not dumb. He was very smart, wrote poetry. Now, Cooper, of course, still not converted, struggled with mental health issues. And even in his 20s, before he came to Christ, big moments of depression and sadness. suicidal thoughts. Throughout his life, he attempted suicide. This, in summary, one time he went and bought a bottle of poison, intending to drink it. By the providence of God, for whatever reason, he couldn't get the lid off, much to his frustration. On another time, when he tried suicide, he was going to hang himself. And he tried several times. The rope broke right as he was losing consciousness, much to his frustration. You wake up alive on the floor and say, I can't even kill myself. Another moment, he went and he was going to drown himself. He went down to the harbor, jumped into the water to end it all, only to discover the tide was out and it was not very deep. So he went home depressed from that. I can't even kill myself. I don't make fun of him. You understand? This is a lost, lost soul. Wow. But that's the story of his poor attempts to end his own life. He ended up in one of his, I think his second depressive episode, he ended up in a place called St. Albans. It was a wonderful title. We'd love to title our care facilities this. Let's see here. I have to find it because I don't want to miss it. St. Albans Insane Asylum. How would you like to check into that place? Wow. Well, he did. Well, he needed to be there. So in his 30s, I believe it was, he ended up in this St. Albans, providentially, hand of God, in the care of a 50-some-year-old doctor who was a warm-hearted evangelical believer who loved Jesus and saw that as his ministry to care for souls. And as he got to know William Cooper, he grew to love this lost young man, 20 years his junior. And so as this doctor cared for him and sought to do the best, you understand, these are the 1700s. So medications and all the different things that are available today, not there. So this doctor, doing his best, knowing this young man does not know Christ, he was doing these tricky things like leaving open Bibles around, you know, hoping that this depressed young man would maybe somehow find his way to Jesus. And he did. He did. Open Bible one morning, and he could tell the story better than I. You can find his story in different places, that he found the Word of God opened and was astounded to think that God could love a mess like him. And on one morning there at St. Albans Insane Asylum, this 30-some-year-old, very lost young man came to Christ. Open Bible. Now, many of us, depending on our theological traditions, would end up saying, well, then he should be healed, right? And sometimes God works that way, doesn't he? Miraculously and providentially delivering someone from either a physical illness or a mental illness. But let's just say, not always does he do that. Not always. God never promises that. So lest you think that by whatever hand you're going to lay on people, they're going to be fixed. Our discussion here today is about the chronically discouraged and depressed, and he was that. Well, he came to Christ. He began to grow in his faith, the doctor mentoring him. He loved the place so much. It was a place of healing and change for him. He stayed an additional 12 months. He was there for like a year and a half. Can you imagine? I mean, are you ever going to get well and go home? Well, a year and a half he was there. Went on about his life. Oh, there were so many issues that just continued to discourage him. His dad wanted him to go into the practice of law. But he was, as a tender-hearted guy, knew he could never do this upfront stuff. There was going to be an examination to see if he could pass whether it was the bar or something equivalent to this. He was so depressed and scared of this, standing up in front of people to be quizzed. That brought along another depressive and suicidal attempt. He just couldn't do it. That was one of those moments when he attempted to escape, his attempt to escape that pressure by killing himself. Before long, he left St. Albans. He moved in with a family. Remember, he lost his mom when he was young. He moved in with the family, husband, wife. I don't know about kids. I couldn't find that recorded anywhere. And this lady, and along with her husband, took him in. Again, smaller houses, you understand. So you're very much a part of the family. The lady of the house was 8 years older than him. And by the relationship, became more of a mother figure to him. And was in that role in his life till she died. Much needed for him. Oh, I should tell you about this as well as you think about these things. He fell in love once. He did. He fell in love and pursued a young lady for 7 years as she was in love with him, hoping to be married. They were engaged. When it came time to tie the knot, her dad said no. Any ideas why? Well, yeah, they were cousins. Now, why anybody would let cousins date for 7 years without letting them know earlier, hey, this is probably not a good idea, but no one knows, but that's what they let them do. They pursued each other for 7 years, could never get married. Neither one ever married, neither he nor she ever married. Both of them loved each other till they died. Brokenhearted. You start thinking about all these things, okay? Career, dad presses him to do something he doesn't love, scared to death to do, artist personality, extreme losses, a broken heart from a lost love, never to be regained. Throughout his life, he wrote poetry, and some of his poems were about this girl that he loved. And once they broke up, because they knew they couldn't marry, I don't think he ever saw her again. But his heart was always with her, as hers was with him. He wrote poetry about her. Sadness, loss, one thing after another. Well, somewhere along the way, 2 years later, the husband of the house is in an accident, falls off a horse and dies. Okay? He stays in this family relationship. They end up moving to another place called Olney, where there was a pastor. And this begins our discussion of a role of a pastor or a helper. There's a pastor here who also lost his mother when he was young. A warm-hearted pastor who came to Christ after quite an interesting life. His name was John Newton. Yeah, no kidding. John Newton was William Cooper's pastor for 13 years. How interesting. Amazing grace. Exercised in the role of a pastor. Well, John Newton came to know them because he heard about the horse accident with this gentleman, and he came to make a visit, and that's when he met William Cooper. They became friends. John Newton welcomed William Cooper into his life, took him on walks. He had a philosophy of helping people with mental illness by saying, "You need to get up, young man. You're too introspective. You're sitting there depressed all the time. Get up. Come with me." Interesting. Others tried to get William Cooper to get busy too, involving the care of stray animals. At one point, it was like he had a veritable zoo around him of animals to care for. Newton was doing a similar thing. Care for people. Cooper, get up, man. So he would take him on visits with him, talk to him about caring for people, spend time together. He spent time with him over a period of 13 years. Cooper would say of his friendship with John Newton, here's a phrase for you, a sincerer or more affectionate friend no one ever had. That's how he described his 13 years of close friendship with John Newton. Now, providentially, who knows why and how, maybe there's other reasons for it, John Newton ended up moving to another town. They stayed in touch by correspondence over the next 20 years. These are the days of handwritten letters back and forth. I have a copy of this. I would have brought more books on this trip, but I was right at the too much stuff. But I've got an old bound book of William Cooper's letters to all the different people in his life, his lost love to John Newton, all the different letters that he wrote in a little hardbound book written. Oh, goodness, it's at least 100 years old. Letters of William Cooper. Well, he corresponded, of course, but listen, during this time of 13 years, please get this, Newton saw Cooper's bent to melancholy and reclusiveness, and he saw that it was there to stay. That enters us into the topic of the day. So what do you do? What do you do? I'm going to step ahead here. There's so many other details of this story, but I've given a fair amount. I want to look for one more place. Yes. Okay. I have that available. Okay. I want you to think with me about all of these. Life experiences, personality. Every 10 years, major depressive episode, even after he came to Christ. At times he would sit for days and days and days looking out the window, not able to function. Despair, believing that he was lost. This is the man who wrote, "There is a fountain filled with blood drawn from Emmanuel's veins." He's the author. He's the author of another poem, I think made into a song, also called God Moves in a Mysterious Way, His Wonders to Perform. Yeah, he plants his footsteps on the sea, rides above the storm. Wonderful poetry. Interesting journey with faith. His pastor and his true friend. A couple more quotes, and then I want to step to four things, okay, that I think I want to talk about as we care for people. So a couple of quotes from another person on this. Listen carefully. We should be slow to judge the needs and possibilities of another person's mental health. If you were to meet with the William Cooper, be careful about judging him and saying, well, goodness sakes, there's something wrong with you. Okay, hold on. Listen well. Ask a lot of questions. I think those are two of the best counseling skills you can ever develop. Listening and asking wise questions. Help me understand. Tell me more about. What were you hoping to see when that took place? What were you longing for? At that moment, what did you love the most? What was happening in your heart right then? Can you tell me something about that? What were you hoping would happen? Rather than saying, that was stupid, you could say, what were you hoping to see happen as a result of that? Because you were hoping for something. You don't do something, anything, without wanting something as a result. I wanted to feel better. I wanted to, okay. Don't make your mercy. I'm reading somebody else here. Don't make your mercy to the downcast contingent on quick results. Isn't that good? Yeah. Keep soaking that person in the benevolence, mercy, and goodness and sympathy of Jesus and the sufficiency of the atonement and the fullness and completeness of Christ's justification. That phrase is because over and over again in William Cooper's life, he was sure he was damned. He was sure of it. Someone said to him once, no, you're an object of God's mercy. And he began to argue about that. I am not. God has intended, he put me on earth to be miserable. That's very evident by my life. And I'm sure to end up apart from him for eternity. And then finally here, keep telling that person of the glory of Christ and his all-sufficient sacrifice for sin. Pray that in God's time, these truths may yet be given the power to awaken hope and beget a spirit of adoption. So keep telling them again. Okay, more on that in a minute. I want to think with you about four practices or disciplines or cautions. These are all on your sheet, but I want to talk about them with you. So presence. This is one of the pastoral care elements for chronically discouraged and depressed people, is your ministry of presence. You're aware of this when you're dealing with someone who is grieving. I hope that you all know, to be not like Job's counselors when they talked all the time. Be like Job's counselors when they sat with him when he was grieving and didn't talk. Sometimes you sit with someone who is grieving deeply and you are better off just being there. There are wonderful things written in counseling material about caring for people in seasons of grief and loss that remind us of the ministry of presence. But when you think about a person who's chronically discouraged and depressed, your conversations with them need to shift from, today I want to fix you, because you probably won't, to how can I be the presence of Christ with you today? Now, that can look different ways. I put on here, that might depend, you know, depending on the circumstance and the person and the setting and so on, it might involve regular meetings, it might involve phone calls, emails, other touch points, I'm not sure. In a very acute season where someone is self-harming, you're familiar with, cutting, suicidal ideation, suicidal attempts, it might involve pretty regular contact, you being very available. We'll talk more about the other side of that in a minute. But the ministry of presence, that's what John Newton was doing with William Cooper when he took him for long walks. By the way, something good about going for walks, there are benefits to this, such as fresh air, physical movement. Often depressed people don't want to move. They need endorphins. You ever heard of those? Yeah, one way you get that is by walking, moving. So going for a walk with someone can stimulate the body to help heal itself, or not. But fresh air, movement, exercise, these are good practices for people. So there are a number of times I've counseled people while moving. Let's take a walk. And sometimes it's safer too, depending on who I'm with, because if I'm going for a walk, guess what? I'm in public. And I'm pretty sure they're not going to do something like a lot of extreme behavior, like yelling, shouting, and hurting themselves in public. So I'm much safer here to take a walk. Tell me about your life. Let's just talk. And it also is easier. Think about this, please. I don't know all of your, in terms of your counseling practice type things, the setting you're working in. One of the benefits of walking is it allows that person to choose to look at you or not. And if they're going to self-disclose something significant, face-to-face contact can be very intimidating. Let's see here. Can I borrow your chair here for 1 second? This is my life. When I set up to meet with somebody, I think about how my office is. Okay? So the door is over here. Where should I be? If you're sitting here, where should I be? I should be on this side. Why? Because if I'm over here, I could make this person feel like they can't escape. They're blocked in.
Cornered.
Yet cornered, stuck, deer in the headlights. So I'm always going to put myself over here to allow the person, I won't say it, but the door, they can leave if they must. And if I'm going to rearrange the chair, and I have a desk where I study, and then I have a table here, that if I'm going to meet with you, I will never do this. Tell me about your problems. This is really awkward. Okay, so don't do that. So I will always be at a 45-degree angle where that person can talk and doesn't have to look at me. So think about the setup of, I don't just mean a counseling room. I mean wherever you're at in meeting. If you're at a restaurant or something, I'm always wanting to be at a place where you're comfortable and there's body language. I'm going to be like this. And we're going to talk. Okay? And I understand the whole don't cross your arms, open. Oh my goodness sakes. But I'm gonna want to engage you in conversation this way, knowing that you may choose to look there and it's fine. But taking a walk, what a wonderful thing. What a wonderful thing. But the ministry of presence, I would just put that number one on your list. In your counseling time with the person who's chronically discouraged and depressed, I want to go here next. This is right after the ministry of presence. Wow, boundaries. You familiar with this? This is rough. You're aware, I put this on your sheet, that when people do lifeguard training, like to work at a swimming pool, they're taught that if you're not careful, that person will kill you. So somebody who's struggling with flailing their arms and about to drown, the worst thing you can do is get too close, because they will wrap their arms around you and drown you both. Okay? That's why lifeguards routinely have those cool floaty things. And they're smart enough. They won't come that close. They'll extend it to you. Now, unless you're unconscious, then they'll grab you by the head and swim, But if you're alive and struggling, they're going to say, okay, close enough to help, not close enough to let you drown me. See any wisdom here for counseling? Wow. Yeah. The drowning person can drown you too. So yes, during times of acute need, I understand and I'm there to call me any time of day or night. But that can't last forever, that you call me any time or day or night. There have to be limits and boundaries. Okay, now we're at a place where this. And my wife and I are involved in a number of people's lives. Again, I have to be careful about details and so on, but we sometimes have those conversations. And even things like suicidal ideation or comments can be an attempt. You got to discern this as a counselor person, whether it's they're really thinking about leaving us or if it's a way to get your attention again. And it can feel almost mean to say, I can't take your call right then. Sorry. That's a tough call. But boundaries, boundaries, boundaries. And I'm saying here as well, please know your limits. Okay? You have some. I mean, physically, mentally, emotionally. Many of you have families. For you to always step away from your children playing on the floor to counsel somebody who thinks you're in a crisis at that moment, don't get me wrong, they may be, and maybe you need to step away from the children. But always, and every time they call, you may be encouraging bad behavior. So be wise about this. They can drown their counselors. Yes, oh boy. Hopefully you're all thinking right here about what this could look like. What are your limits? Today, with cell phones, we're available 24/7. Is that good? Sometimes. I routinely, if someone is dealing with death and impending death, I will give them my card with my phone number and I will say, call me day or night. If you would like me to be present, I would be happy to be with you when your loved one passes. If that's a difficult thing for you, I've been there. I know what this is like. I'd be happy to be alongside you at that time. I've gone to the hospital in the middle of the night. That took place with one of my sisters. Call me anytime. Yeah. And I was there from midnight till, well, whenever. And I was there when she died. She didn't want to be alone. No problem. Okay, that's different than a person who's chronically struggling and might want you there all the time. How about that? So we think about these things. We think about these things. Goals. What are some reasonable goals in your time together? If your goal cannot be, we're going to fix you in the next 8 weeks. Okay, what is it? What are we doing? What are we talking about? How can we make progress? What are reasonable goals? Again, some of you like things neat and tidy and struggle with longer term. That's why I'm talking about this. Is your goal, if you're dealing with a longer term situation, figuring out what your goals are. I think John Newton had goals as he met with William Cooper. Let's get you physically active. Let's get you interacting with people more rather than sitting and staring out the window. Come with me. Come with me. Really, John. William, come with me. Walk with me. So he had some goals that he was after, things he was trying. Maybe it would work, maybe it didn't. But sometimes, like I say here, sometimes there's a crisis, sometimes it's more longer term. Reasonable goals. Boy, it's hard sometimes, you guys. I know this. I have the t-shirts on this. It is hard. It's really hard finding the right goals. It's really hard when somebody says, I just don't feel like it. Because you can't make anybody do anything, can you? You ever noticed? Yeah, I have. Yeah, you can recommend and encourage. Yeah. What kind of a goal? Okay, I would love to see you getting some kind of regular physical exercise. Okay? Let's work on that in the next couple months. What do you think that would look like for you? Okay, I hate weightlifting. I don't know how to swim. Okay, can we talk about what that would look like? What would it look like for you to get some kind of physical exercise? And you talk them through that. And then maybe for a period of time you're saying, when you meet again, so are you still walking your dog 3 times a week? Tell me about that. Where'd you go? How's your dog doing? You know, and I'm going to ask, tell me about that. But I didn't go very much because, okay, well, listen, I'll tell you what. By the time we meet again, let's get to that 3 times a week. And next time we meet, I want to hear from you. You tell me, walk the dog 3 times for at least half an hour. Endorphin limit, 20 minutes. Come on. Tell me. That would be an example of a reasonable goal. Or I tell you what, let me hook you up with some kind of Sunday morning ministry of handing out bulletins. every other Sunday for the next 2 months. Let's see if you can do it. It means you got to show up 4 times. Can you do it? I think you can. We would love to have you involved. So those would be reasonable goals. Does it mean they're fixed? No, but it means you took a step. Okay? That'd be an example of a goal. And then finally here, I've alluded to this already, said it directly, patience, know how God has wired you. Know how God has wired you as a counselor. But these things take time. And I put on your sheet here a wonderful quote that I just think you should read and read and read again until you get it. Never cease to sing the gospel to the deaf. Oh, that's so good. Don't make your mercy to the downcast contingent on quick results. True saints enter dark seasons. And should they die in the midst of one, it is no sure sign they were not born again, nor that they were not sustained in their darkness by the sovereign hand of God. I don't know if any of you have had this, but Kathy and I have worked with people with suicidal ideation or suicidal habits or thoughts or threats and wondered, what if they do it? I hope they don't. But it's a rough thing to come to the conclusion they might. And I can't stop them. So I must not take it upon myself to be God, because you won't be good at it. You can't be there all the time. Could somebody you're working with commit suicide? Absolutely. I sure hope they don't. So our tendency these days at a certain point in a counseling relationship is to say, I sure hope you don't do that. I mean, I hope you don't. But if I always say, and call me every single time, do you see any dangers with that? Yeah. At a certain point, I remember not too long ago, again, I'll keep it very, very vague, telling a person who was asking about something, how about this? Saying, no, I can't help you with that. Said person responded to me, that's really mean. And I said, no, I'm helping you because you can do this. And you don't need me to be there. I need you to know that. So get up and do that. I think it was the right thing. If you have not read some of William Cooper's work, you should. If you're not familiar with all the words of there is a fountain filled with blood, ere since by faith I saw the stream, talking about the blood of Jesus, thy flowing wound supply, redeeming love has been my theme and shall be till I die. He wrote in one of his better times. God moves in a mysterious way. I've kept this in my Bible for years. Judge not the Lord by feeble sense, but trust him for his grace. Beneath a frowning providence, he hides a smiling face. This is a rich poem. If you've never read it, Google it, print it, carry it with you. God does move in a mysterious way. And sometimes by allowing God's dear children to go through difficult times.